Welcome to the Ho Center for Buddhist Studies at Stanford podcast. Come join us by the tree. The first step following a PhD in religious studies used to be clear. Start turning your dissertation into the monograph that you'll one day submit to a tenure review committee. But as job openings in the discipline have dropped 40% over the last two decades, and entire departments faced cuts coast to coast last year, it's time to reevaluate. Who else outside that imagined committee might read your research? What other kinds of writing, including translations, would interest that new audience? And where else can you take your training as, say, a teacher of the Buddhist canon, a reader in Sanskrit and Middle Chinese, or an archivist versed in ritual manuals? While the majority of humanities doctorates still work in post-secondary education, broadly conceived, the next most common career is often just across campus, in museums and libraries. Our guest today has seen the university from both sides, from behind the syllabus and the stacks, first as an associate professor and then as a university librarian. Looking out into the uncertain future that tomorrow's doctorates face, that double perspective improves our depth perception. First, for the kinds of publications that should count on the tenure track. Second, for the kinds of in-class experience that should count for a library curator.
And I basically just said, look, I have a PhD in this field. I taught in this field for 8 years. I trained graduate students in this field. I've been an undergraduate, graduate student, professor, and mentor of graduate students in this field. So I think I understand what people are expecting from the library.
My guest today is Joshua Capitano, curator and public services librarian at the East Asia Library at Stanford. Josh received his PhD in East Asian Languages and Civilizations from the University of Pennsylvania in 2008, and was assistant and then associate professor of religious studies at the University of the West in California until 2016, before arriving here at Stanford. We'll be talking today about that transition and about Josh's continued writing in his new role. Josh's current scholarship focuses on Buddhist, Chinese medicine, and Taoist ritual theory. His recent articles appear in the Journal of the American Academy of Religion, History of Religions, and Newman, International Review for the History of Religions, and he has published translations in 84,000 Asian Medicine and the anthology Buddhism in Medicine. He is himself the editor of the Journal of East Asian Libraries. As usual, our conversation takes place in Littlefield Center at the Buddhist Studies Library, a backdrop that feels especially appropriate for this episode. So let's head there now. Thank you so much, Josh, for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So I guess I thought we would start with the research. Talk a little bit about your interest in medieval China, medieval Chinese religion, Buddhism and Taoism and their relationship to one another. How did you gravitate towards that particular field in the first place?
Sure. Well, I started with an interest in Buddhism, like as a child. I was interested in Buddhism. My parents had a lot of books on religion and philosophy. I remember my sixth grade teacher stole my copy of the Tao Te Ching.
Stole for their own reading?
Yeah. I wrote a report on it and she asked me to borrow it and then I never got it back. In high school I became interested in Buddhism specifically. I was a philosophy major when I went to college the first time. And then I dropped out and was like working as a computer programmer and just kind of like studying Buddhism on my own. I was interested in Zen Buddhism. I was reading a lot of like translations and I started to wonder about the quality of the translations. I thought maybe I would be able to understand it better if I could understand the language. So, I came to understand that Zen Buddhism had come from China and that most of the texts that I was reading had been translated from Chinese. So I started learning Chinese and ended up going back to college and doing a bachelor's in Chinese at UCLA, where I had the chance to take a bunch of classes on Buddhism with different professors and kind of became interested in Chinese as well, like having, beginning to learn the language. I kind of got interested in the literary tradition. So I went to grad school with the intention of working on Chinese Buddhism. I went to University of Pennsylvania, where I worked with Victor Mayer. And just, I think my first or second year there, I encountered the work of Michelle Strickman. His Chinese magical medicine book had just been published, which is like really, you know, a really important work on the relationship between Buddhism and Taoism, specifically like Buddhist and Taoist ritual in medieval China. And I encountered Steve Bokenkamp's book, Early Taoist Scriptures. And I was really interested in the last section of that, which deals with this particular Taoist tradition, the Lingbao school, which had kind of like borrowed a lot of terms and ideas from the Buddhist scriptures that were being translated into China at the time. So I remember writing I took a class with Victor on, it was on the history of the Chinese language, which is like one of his sort of pet topics. He's really interested in that. And I wrote a paper on this device that you found in those Taoist texts called the hidden Brahma Lang, which basically was an attempt to kind of create a Chinese origin for like the transliterated Sanskrit terms that you find in Buddhist literature. And he liked the paper, and I think he sensed that I was interested in these kinds of connections between Buddhism and indigenous Chinese religion. So he ended up like the next year doing a whole graduate seminar on the topic of like so-called Buddho-Taoism. Yeah, I don't know, that just kind of became my thing. I'm curious about that,
yeah, the Buddho-Taoism, because you mentioned in passing, you know, all these mentors, but then also reading Stephen Bokenkamp's Early Taoist Scriptures, and we, you know, he was a guest of the Ho Center recently and sat in on this podcast, so naturally I kind of want to seize on that a little bit, because there is a thread in your research that is partly about the rivalry of Taoism and Buddhism in this field, in terms of who came to what ideas and you know, which ones are sort of properly elevated or terrestrial. You know, that revolve around, among other things, this notion of self-cultivation or internal alchemy, where, you know, some, you know, between, you're interested, I think, in, it seems like, in Taoism insofar as it uses talismans and rituals, but insofar as it also uses meditation forms and questions of where that arises. Can you tell us about sort of how your thinking about the relationship of those two religions has evolved and maybe where it is now?
So I think I initially was interested in how Buddhism became sort of Chinese, Sinicized. I was really influenced by Zerker's work on, you know, the Buddhist conquest of China, and so I was more approaching Taoism from this Buddhist angle, and I was curious about the fact that Taoists were like using Buddhist terms and kind of, you know, copying Buddhist literary tropes in their scriptures. And so most of the early work I did on this in graduate school was kind of from that angle. I was very excited. The one project that I did as a grad student, which I've continued like milking, I mean, I just referenced it in an article I wrote earlier this year, was when I found this text in the Taoist canon that attributed like a method of internal alchemy to Bodhidharma, the, you know, the patriarch of Zen Buddhism in China. And so I was really interested in that sort of, and, you know, there's kind of a, I think even before I had gone to grad school, I had encountered the idea in like, I don't know, maybe like Arthur Whaley or Kenneth Chen or something, about how, you know, Chinese Buddhists, there's this sort of vague idea that Chinese Buddhism was influenced by Taoism, and that, you know, particularly the like most quintessentially Chinese forms of Buddhism, like Chan Buddhism, show some sort of Taoist influence, but it's never really explained clearly how that happened. I think it's just a general sense that this doesn't seem exactly like Indian Buddhism. There's something very Chinese about it, yeah. And this must have come from.
But it sounds like some of your arguments are also pointing to the way in which the influence goes the other direction, and that's important too.
Well, yeah. I mean, so I sort of started from that idea that, you know, Taoists were kind of like stealing from Buddhism, and I think that was sort of my gateway into Taoist studies itself. And so I kind of like became a Taoist studies. I mean, it I began to get a little bit annoyed with this kind of like facile and explanation that, you know, Taoists just copy Buddhists.
Sure.
And I started, you know, the more I actually read Taoist texts, the more I started to at least think that I could perceive some sort of internal logic and see even the sort of wholesale appropriation of some Buddhist elements as a kind of strategic move that that sort of made sense in a way, or was made sense of at some point.
So on the other side of it, you know, just to pick up a kind of impossibly big question that you dropped in the path here, which is how did Buddhism become Chinese? Do you have your own thesis on that now, or is there a thesis that you gleaned from this community of scholars you were working with that you feel is correct?
Yeah, I don't know. I kind of go back and forth on it. I mean, Bob Scharf just gave a talk here on the origins of koan literature, and that has given me a lot to think about it.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think that the general story of how Buddhism became Chinese is wrong. I think it's true that like Chinese people, you know, made Buddhism Chinese, but in many ways by kind of
aligning it with religious traditions that were already in place.
Yeah, finding ways to sort of translate Indian Buddhist concepts into Chinese, or reframe Indian Buddhist ideas in contexts that were more kind of amenable to like Chinese modes of thought. The idea that it was like as simple as just Chinese Buddhists kind of interpreted Buddhism through Taoist frameworks, I don't particularly agree with.
Yeah.
In actuality, like on both sides, people really knew what they were doing and what they were about. And, you know, any kind of crossover that you see between the two traditions is intentional.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not just kind of like haphazard, you know.
Yeah. And that's doing a disservice to centuries of scholars who are thinking about this pretty seriously. Yeah, that makes sense. And the reason why, you know, I'm starting to think about it now a little bit in terms of evaluating these historical figures as scholars is because I'm curious to connect this to what you see as being your own methods that you were trained in and that you have now taken with you into a new vocation. Because I think one thing we'll end up talking about in this conversation is the skills that one learns in this field in graduate school and on the tenure track, and ways in which those skills can be responsibly used or effectively used in other avenues. And so as you're looking at, you know, historical scholars who are thinking both within their own tradition about their own primary texts and their own primary scriptures and intertextually and maybe interculturally or interreligiously about other texts that are out there, you know, what that brings to mind for me is looking at your own articles and thinking about the way in which there is a strong reliance on your own sense of primary sources, your own abilities to do translations, which has now become a big part of your work, as well as, of course, the running footnotes that involve being aware of what other scholars have said, as you've mentioned, being aware of this entire community of people you've worked with and whose mentors you know kind of by association. So tell us a little bit about how you take those two tracks of, you know, humanistic academic engagement, translation, curation, historical work that involves primary sources, and the secondary, and how you think about those skills in your current work, you know, as somebody who is working in special collections in some ways with primary sources, also trying to stay, you know, up to date and keep everybody else up to date in the secondary research. How has your own training enabled you to keep, you know, those two aspects of scholarship alive?
Well, yeah, I mean, I've kind of ended up in the perfect situation in that I'm covering East Asian studies and religious studies here at Stanford, and my own training was sort of, I mean, at Penn, I would say, like, getting a degree in East Asian studies, at least with the people with whom I was studying, there was not much of a method or a methodology. It was really just learn to read Chinese really well and read as much Chinese as you can. And then at the same time, I was taking classes at Princeton with Stephen Tizer in the religious studies department, and getting exposed to a more kind of religious studies approach, which is very methodology heavy. And actually, after I graduated, because I sort of decided that I wanted to be in the religious studies field, I really made a lot of efforts on my own to kind of fix what I felt were some deficiencies in my own training related to my familiarity or my lack of familiarity with specifically like secondary scholarship in the field of religious studies. And I'm personally very interested in sort of theory, theoretical approaches that are important in the field of religious studies. And for a while, those were like kind of separate endeavors. And I used to get really frustrated when I was reading religious studies scholarship, because most of it is about Western religions. And it was hard for me to see how that could be applied, how I could apply those things to Chinese religion. So I was really, there are a few scholars, Rob Campany is the person that comes to mind immediately, whose work was really important for me in terms of providing kind of a model of how to connect those. And so like in my own scholarship, you know, as you can see, I tend to prefer to publish in more like religious studies journals, and to write more from to write about Chinese religions, you know, using Western theoretical approaches. But then, yeah, also, I mean, as a librarian, those are exactly the fields that I cover. So I have to also be familiar with what people are going to be, what kind of resources people might need as scholars of East Asia, and also what kinds of things people might need as scholars of religion. So
Yeah, that's great. And I can totally understand how it is, in fact, a perfect fit, you know, the kinds of background that you have and the kind of work you're doing now. But I wonder, because, you know, a lot of students who go through the PhD track, who maybe, you know, do visiting assistant professorships or postdoctoral positions before looking at something like library work or other kinds of university jobs, worry about, you know, how hyper-specialized they may be in a particular area before they offer, you know, a different kind of service to these institutions, and being able to prove that, right, to an interview committee. And so, you know, can you talk about, just in practical terms, what it was like to go after this job here, and, you know, and explain what you thought you could bring to the library, and explain that the kind of training you had done, you know, which tends to be traditionally for a particular kind of instructor and researcher role, made sense in this other domain?
Yeah. I mean, the position that I applied for was different than the position that I'm doing. I mean, it's the same position, but the role was defined differently at the time. So, you know, now, you know, like in my signature, I'm like a curator for East Asian studies and curator for religious studies and public services librarian. Like, technically, that's about like an 80-20 split between my curatorial duties and the public services stuff. But when I was hired, I mean, the job that I applied for was actually like, it was just public services librarian, and then the curatorial stuff was kind of an add-on. So it was like 60% public services, 40% curation. And I mean, I got super lucky. Like, that was really the perfect job for me to apply for at the time, because public services is more about, I mean, I remember like when I was preparing for the job, trying to figure out what exactly it is. I think if you ask 10 public service librarians, they'll give you 10 different answers. But I mean, it's really just doing the public facing part of the library. And the main thing there is communication skills. So, I mean, I was, you know, I have a PhD. I had been a professor for 8 years. I think it was fairly easy for me to make the argument that I have, you know, the level of verbal and written communication skills needed for something like this.
Right. You're an established writer. You're an established teacher.
Yeah. I mean, I can write. I'm comfortable, you know, talking to people mostly, and I know how to like respond to emails, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, it was really just sort of a matter of convincing them that I could do the communication side of things. And then, you know, there was this 40% curatorial stuff that at the time I didn't really know exactly what that involved. But, you know, I think it was I basically just said, look, I have a PhD in this field. I taught in this field for 8 years. I trained graduate students in this field. I've been an undergraduate, graduate student, professor, you know, and mentor of graduate students in this field. So I think I understand what people are expecting from the library.
Yeah.
And then what ended up happening is that, you know, as I learned more about the collection development side or the subject specialist side or whatever, you know, I kind of gravitated towards that kind of work because it was more, it was the kind of work that made, I think, better use of my own skill set. I mean, you know, the public services stuff, like I think a lot of people can do. It's really just, you know, staying on top of communication and you know, creating events in the calendar. And and so I've you know, I've been here for almost 10 years. I've kind of gradually taken on more collection development and now recently more, even more kind of like metadata and special collection stuff that again directly uses these like skills that I have that other people don't. But yeah, I think initially that was like a really good position for getting my foot in the door because it was partly public services and I could, it was, I really just had to make a case that I was like a decent communicator. And then I had the opportunity to kind of learn the more technical collection development side stuff on the job.
That makes
and
sense.
Then eventually kind of move into that area.
Yeah, neat. So one thing that also it sounds like changed or that you gained a new appreciation for in those early years of moving to a new position was knowing other kinds of communities that exist in the university and between different universities, right? Because you had this community that we've talked about of mentors and advisors and colleagues, but there is also a community, you know, that maybe, you know, folks in grad school or maybe even folks in faculty departments aren't always as aware of librarians who are working together and collaborating together on these events, on these projects, on these public facing initiatives. So what was it like to discover or maybe just integrate yourself into that community, you know, leading all the way up to, you know, running this journal that is representative of a community?
It was great. Librarians are, I like librarians. And I mean, I remember seeing things as a graduate student in my own department. And I mean, I've heard lots of stories about, you know, departments that don't maybe function as well as they could, or, you know, individual egos. I mean, I think the kind of people that gravitate toward library work are not like the sort of like, look at me kind of people, you know. I mean, I really enjoy actually sort of being in a support role. And so, I mean, I think the library community in general is just very, it's very supportive. It's very collaborative. We have our own, like there's a professional society that I'm part of, the Council on East Asian Libraries. You know, the day I started, my former boss sent an email to the group. They added me to the group. Everybody, you know, I was getting emails from all these people. Congratulations, you know. Went to the conference, people are coming up to me, like, oh, you know, like introducing them. So it's just a very like, pro networking, really welcoming community.
And then throughout that time, you've also continued to write, but the writing has taken on a different emphasis, right? Like you're doing more translation work. You're maybe thinking about big projects a little bit differently. What did you realize in that time? Like in what ways did this not writing for a tenure review committee, for instance, free up in terms of other possible work?
And when I came to Stanford, I had a couple different projects that were still going on, and I knew that I wanted to at least get these articles that I had in development published, and was hoping that I would be able to continue publishing. I had been thinking about a monograph for a while, and yeah, I did. I remember reading. I just recently completed the draft of what hopefully will end up being my first monograph, and it has nothing to do with my dissertation, or it was a completely new project. And yeah, I remember reading this interview in something like Chronicle of Higher Education with an author who was talking about their new book, and they were saying, "Oh, you know, because this is my second book, the first book was really like I was locked into this formula of, you know, publish your dissertation and get it out as quickly as possible. And now that this is my second book, you know, I feel really excited because I'm able to try new things. And yeah, I remember thinking, well, this is great. I can just write my first book can be my second book. I'm not, if I do end up writing a book, which at the time I wasn't even sure I would, you know, it's not going to affect my progression as a librarian. It's not going to, I mean, it's like a nice thing to have, but mm-hmm. it's not for tenure. I'm not doing it to meet any requirements. So mm-hmm. it's kind of like, I could write any kind of book. I could do translations, which I had always been advised to, you know, not spend a lot of time on because they're not considered maybe as important by a tenure review committee as other things. But I really like doing translations. So I always thought that was kind of too bad. Like if more people were doing more translations, we would have a lot more translated stuff, which probably in the end might be better than having all of these monograph, you know, published dissertations, whatever.
Yeah. So there's a certain way in which what has become institutionally expected in terms of the writing that you have to do to get a PhD, the writing that you have to do for the following stages, you know, has some utility, but is also confining, where the possibility of working more on translations, more on a sort of second book model where you're thinking more about a large audience rather than about the audience of three that is your dissertation committee or your tenure review committee or what have you, might actually be not just good for you as a writer, but good for the public, good for the field. Maybe in some kinds of ways, it leads me to another detail that I remember from a conversation we had a couple months ago when we were thinking about this interview, where when I read a lot of material and attend classes or conferences about this crisis in the humanities and crisis in higher education at large, where a lot of PhD students are looking for places to go with their degrees that may not be the professoriate because, you know, maybe because they're not interested in that career or maybe because that career is rapidly closing and dwindling, and it's a really difficult problem. It's often framed, you know, in the kind of optimistic think pieces and books and conferences as your particular training, your particular skills provide you an opportunity that you're not realizing or a set of opportunities, which is great. And I think it is real and is true that we need to think about having cultivated a lot of tools that do have use in various disciplines that we just have to get your foot in the door, like you said, with an initial position that allows you to learn a new area. But you also put it differently. You said, yes, opportunity, but also responsibility, that you've also been trained in a particular way to know particular things, to have a particular knowledge base, a particular set of skills that the world can use, that the field can use, that the public can use, that the university certainly can use. And you want to be able to do something with that too going forward. So could you say a little bit about that kind of reframing of what it is to have this background and, you know, how you treat that responsibility personally?
Yeah, I mean, that's a, of course, like a really personal thing. I would not expect everyone to feel that way or, you know, fault anyone for not feeling that way. Sure. But yeah, I mean, for me, there's kind of two separate but related thing. One is that, as I mentioned, I got into Buddhism in the first place through some interest in translation. You know, I was like 18 and I was like reading these books and I was meditating and I was like, I'm not becoming enlightened. It must be because I don't know Chinese, you know what I mean? Like, which is kind of a silly thing, but, you know, my interest was like aroused and sustained because there were enough things available in translation that I could kind of, oh, I read the Platform Sutra. I guess I should read, you know, the Yulu of the Five Houses. You know, there was like stuff to read. And, you know, I spent a lot of time learning how to read Buddhist texts with different experts. I'm still learning, you know, here at Stanford. I'm getting the opportunity to work with people. And, you know, I'm pretty confident that I can read a lot of things pretty well. And, you know, I've read things that other people will never read because they're not available in English. So I enjoy the process of translation. It's just like, you know, it's a, like Confucius said, it's a joy to like get good at something and then do that thing, you know. Mm-hmm. And you know, you can spend the whole day writing an article and then the next day you might end up like throwing everything you wrote away and rewriting it. But like if I spend a day doing a translation, at the end of that day I can be like, okay, you know, I just translated 3 pages of this and now I'm 3 pages closer to the end. So I mean, I enjoy translation work and I have you know, there are these different organizations, 84,000 or BDK. I've had the chance to work with some of these different organizations that are looking for people like me who have the skills and the interest in translation. And the other thing is, in this field of Taoist studies, like I said, I sort of stumbled into this field of Taoist studies and, you know, had the opportunity to train with people who, you know, usually don't train graduate students, and at some point sort of realized that this is actually a really small field, and I'm one of only, you know, like less than 10 people in North America that are actually looking at this, at this particular group of texts from this particular period on this particular topic. Not that I can do it myself, but I feel some obligation to try to keep producing scholarship to contribute to the vitality of that field here in North America, dwindling as it is.
In terms of that final reflection, I thought I would just ask for students, you know, in our program and other programs who are nearing the end of their PhD or are in postdoctoral positions where they don't know what's next and where they don't know where their future lies in these fields and are thinking both about these opportunities and these responsibilities, what would you advise them if they're looking at library jobs, for instance, or other kinds of university jobs? What would you say about preparing for an interview, looking for positions, or just generally how to frame themselves as talented, knowledgeable people whose work should be esteemed?
Well, I would first of all encourage people to look at library positions. Mm-hmm. In East Asian Studies, our professional organization, the Council on East Asian Libraries, we have a job page on our professional organization website, which has a lot of listings. There's a lot, I think, that could be said. There's a lot to learn. There are some schools that are more amenable to hiring PhDs. There are some schools that will require you to have an MLIS degree. So it's good to kind of get an understanding of the difference between those types of things. I think that any kind of library experience that you can get as a graduate student is helpful. Like if you need some extra cash and there's an opportunity available to work in the library, that's a good way to get, you know, it's nice to have that background and you can kind of get a sense for what it's like working in a library. I worked in a library as an undergrad. Most of my classmates when I was a grad student worked in our library. Again, like they're looking for communication skills. They're looking for, if it's, assuming it's like a bibliographer or subject specialist position, they're looking for, like, you know, an understanding of the field, an understanding of what graduate students and faculty will need. And it's pretty easy to make a case that, you know these things as a graduate student or maybe somebody who has teaching experience. So, understanding, I think, just sort of more about how an academic library works and what the different kind of roles are in there is important. I think something like public services or, you know, subject specialist, curator, bibliographer position is easy to make a case for somebody with a humanities PhD. If you want to get into something like metadata or cataloging, then that requires more specialized skills, which you can learn on the job. I got the chance to learn on a job, but most people would go to school to learn those kinds of things. So,
and that's great. And you know, I think just to bring it all together, the idea that on the one hand, you are deserving of a position like that, if you have that kind of training, you are the right kind of fit, but that it also would be affirming to the kinds of things that you've been doing, that, you know, you are testament to that you've been able to continue to do really important work, kind of bringing together important materials, collaborating with other scholars. You know, you've mentioned working with James Gentry and Mikhail Maras here in the Tibetan studies specialty, and finding materials for them, but then also publishing your own work, your own translations and whatnot. And to be able to continue in that way an academic life and an academic vocation that's totally integral to what the university does. You know, I think hopefully that's inspiring for a lot of scholars who are looking for places to go and looking for places to find as a home. So thanks so much for sharing that journey with us, from the research to the profession. And we look forward to seeing you around at lots of Host Center events going forward, as we always do.
Great. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it as well.
Thanks, Josh.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Josh Capitano for joining us on the podcast. You can find Josh's articles and translations linked on ORCID, that is, Open Researcher and Contributor ID. If we can recommend one more piece of writing here, it's an essay by Josh's colleague Regan Murphy Cow that he cited as an important catalyst in his move to Stanford. It's titled From PhD to Librarian, and you can find it online at DR Dissertation Reviews. Our music, as always, comes from Ani Choying Drolma's performance at Memorial Church in 2017. Until next time, this has been the Ho Center for Buddhist Studies at Stanford podcast.